being a part of this, joining this family and getting to know people like Paul and Dan, and I just saw Lebel this morning, and Wes, and Shaul, and all these people, and you realize just these guys are fit. I mean, like exercise and CrossFit and guys running trails and all kinds of stuff, and this was like not my lifestyle. In actual fact, you know, I don't know what it's like for some of you going to the men's camp. But the men's camp, and it's like, oh, we've got this. Tomorrow morning, guys, like 5:30, we're going to have anybody wants to like CrossFit stuff, come and join. Or these guys are running up a trail up the mountain. And those guys are riding on the bicycles all over the place. And I'm sitting there drinking my coffee and taking anti-inflammatories. But afterwards, I realized, you know what, I need to do something. I haven't done like much exercise for a long time. I hate gym. CrossFit's not my thing. Like ball sports was my thing, and I was only playing a little bit of paddle, but I realized, you know, I need to get some exercise. I need to get some activity going. So Shaul, who I reckon is the ambassador for parkruns, he convinced me, you know, that parkruns are good. Let's do parkruns. So, okay, fine. We'll try this out. Sounds cool. Gonna do a park run. So I went to go do my first park run in about 7 years. I only done one before that, which was 7 years before that. And so I went to go do my first park run. Now I'm unfit. I haven't done much exercise, but I'm not gonna run. I'm gonna walk. And lots of people walk, so I felt okay. So there I go, and we start the park run, and I just see people going past me. Anyway, my ego's okay. It's my first one. I'm just walking, and I'm focused, and I'm trying to keep pace. But I don't know. I don't normally do it. I don't know how far 5Ks is. I'm not sure what pace to keep. So I'm trying to like scout people that I can follow. So I scout this one group, and they look like they know what they're doing. And so I'm trying to follow them, and they just disappear. So okay, let me find someone else. And I'm trying to like feel good and find somebody that looks reasonably fit, you know, that I can try and keep up with. So I see this lady in front of me, and she looks like she's quite fit, and I mean that in the most appropriate sense. All right, so like if, for example, how do you tell? So Paul, if you come stand here with me, if you don't mind, just don't worry, it's okay. So if I had to ask you, like which of us would you think is fit, and you'd like to like kind of benchmark your fitness level against? I mean, who would you choose? Yeah. All right, so obviously Paul. I don't know why I think it's so funny, but anyway, obviously. Obviously, Paul is the person you would choose, right? So I see this person in front of me, this lady, and she's right, and I'm kind of keeping pace with her. So I'm like, I'm feeling good. So I'm getting out, keeping pace, and I'm feeling good about myself. Gets a bit of a heel. I start slowing down. This old lady, about 65, starts coming past me, and I'm like, uh-uh, you're not beating me today. And so I kind of, you know, pick up the pace a bit, and I'm huffing and puffing, and so I catch up to the lady that in front of me. I don't know, he must have gone about 3Ks by now. Felt like 20. And then I start catching up to her, and I'm like, oh, sure, I'm doing well. You know, this fit person in front of me, and I'm catching up, and I catch up, and I get there, and I'm starting to overtake her, and I'm feeling really good about myself. And as I overtake her, I look, and I realize this lady's about 7 months pregnant. Which obviously I couldn't see from behind, because she's still like slender, but she's got this huge stomach. And at that moment, I was like, okay, I had to reassess my thoughts on my level of fitness and performance. So I could say that at that point, I rediscovered my level of fitness and performance that I had initially based on what I could see and a whole lot of assumptions that I made, right? Now, in the series we've been doing, Jesus Rediscovered, that's pretty much what we are trying to do. So we see Jesus through a certain lens. We see Jesus in a certain way. We make a whole lot of assumptions about Jesus. And what you're trying to do in this series is to challenge our thoughts and our assumptions and our ideas based on various things about Jesus, so we can get a true and accurate picture, an accurate assessment of who Jesus is and what that means to us in our lives as a Christian family. So today, we're going to touch on something that I think arguably shapes and influences us more than many things on how we behave and live and how we interpret the life and teachings of Jesus. All right, so we're going to do a little test for you first. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up two definitions of a word, and I want you to try and guess or say what the word is that I'm describing. Okay. You know what? I was going to bring a prize, but I forgot what's happening. So you just get the glory of being the person who gets it right. Okay. I think this is on. So let's look. Oh, it works. First time. I'm so happy. Okay. So this is the first definition. The way of life, especially the general customs and beliefs of a particular group of people at a particular time. So that's the first definition. The second definition is the attitudes, behavior, opinions, etc. of a particular group of people within society. Okay, so who thinks they knows what that word is that's being described? Hands up. Taz. Religion? Okay, that's an idea. I know, where's your... Pick somebody else. You said culture. Okay, well done. So that's the word that is being described. And interestingly enough, religion is a big part of... Why did that go ahead? A big part of culture. So a good guess. So I'm going to talk a little bit about culture this morning. Now, the impact and the significance of culture on our lives cannot be underestimated. So Billy Graham says that far too many young people coming of age today have no spiritual or emotional roots. They've been deprived of values by an agnostic and contemporary culture. The other challenge is that often how we read and interpret the scriptures and the life and teachings of Jesus is through the culture that we are in. So Brian McLaren says that too often we see the Bible through whatever lens we get from our culture. So culture has a major impact on how we live our lives and how we behave and how we act and how we see things and our thinking. Now the reality is that, and we're going to go next week, we're going to start a series on the Sermon on the Mount, and it's called People of the Way, if I'm not mistaken, yeah. And basically in this series and Sermon on the Mount, Jesus lays out his, what we call a kingdom manifesto. He basically lays out, in essence, what the kingdom culture should look like. His beliefs, his way, his thoughts on various important topics, and we're going to learn about that from next week on, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. But he lays out the kingdom way of life, and inevitably, there becomes a clash of cultures. So what we have is the culture that we are in, whether it's the modern culture of the world or the West or the traditional cultures that we grew up in, and then we put that against the culture of the kingdom, and we find that some things align, there's some values that maybe are the same, but there are also many that are not, that don't align. And then we end up with a decision and a choice. Do we try and massage and manipulate the Bible and what Jesus says and his teachings to try and fit in with the culture that we are in? Because that culture is so strong, it's what we're comfortable with and what we're used to. Or do we become almost countercultural and say, well, I know this is what the culture says, but this is the kingdom culture that I'm a part of, that I ascribe to. I'm going to follow that and join that and be a part of that and teach that and live that as opposed to the culture that is otherwise influencing us. So I want to look at one example today. And if I press that. Okay. So have any of you heard of cancel culture? Okay, can I put up a hand? You heard of cancel culture? All right. So what is cancel culture for those that don't know? So basically, it's the social attitude, right, that when someone says or does something that's controversial or unpopular or even maybe just don't agree with, there's this attitude that they must be punished through public shaming, through silencing, through boycotting, through being fired, etc., so that that person's influence or even the person's presence is like canceled out. All right. So that's kind of what cancel culture is about. Now, a few things about cancel culture. It's rash. It's like harsh. You know, there's little concern for due process or trying to find out context or what happened. And there's like immediate outrage and judgment. There's irrational thinking and mob mentality, which is not acceptable in the kingdom culture. If you think about it, Proverbs 4 verse 20 says, give careful thought to the path of your feet. So it means consider your ways, consider how you're reacting, consider how you are responding. Titus 1 verse 2 says we must live sensibly. That's an expectation from people of the kingdom. The cancel culture is also spiteful. So comments are often ugly, they're unfair, they're sometimes untrue. It's like the more hatred, the better. That's that kind of culture, cancel culture. Jesus says, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you. Colossians 4 verse 6 says, our speech should be gracious. And then the cancel culture is unforgiving. Like the goal is to defame and to malign people. There's no room for rehabilitation or reconciliation or learning from mistakes. But the Bible says, make allowance for each other's faults and forgive anyone who offends you. How different is the culture of the kingdom to the modern cancel culture? I mean, cancel culture needs to be canceled, right? Now we have a choice. We can get caught up in this cancel culture, which is very prevalent. It's very out there. Look, I mean, I think some of the motives initially might have been okay. You know, where there is abuse and unfairness and injustice, yeah, sure, we should stand up against that, but it's become way worse than that. Now, you might think, oh, well, that's social media. I'm not that on social media. I don't go commenting things. I don't do that. But the thing is, this kind of attitude that's in the culture starts creeping its way into our hearts and into the communities that we are in, and even as believers. So let me take an example. I'm ashamed to say that I've, in my years of being alive, have been caught up in this. What about things like gossip? Right, so then, you know, somebody says something about negative about someone because maybe they don't like what they said or they picked up an offense. So they start, you know, talking about it amongst the group, and then people start jumping on the bandwagon and saying, yes, yes, yeah, I also saw that and I agree. And they start bringing in things and making assumptions, and you get caught up in it because you don't want to feel left out of the group. And maybe you start contributing to this, and now that person, that poor victim, hasn't had a chance to give their side of the story. They start getting ostracized. They didn't even know what happened, and they kind of get canceled out of that little group or that clique or that community or whatever. I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen when I've been at school. I've seen it happen amongst my friends. I've been a victim of it. I've seen it happen at church. I mean, it's probably why Paul is so strong against gossip and slander when he writes his letters in the church. And obviously, it was happening in the church, which is why he had to address it. See, it creeps in. And because of this culture that we start thinking, oh, well, it's okay. You know, it's not such a bad thing. I mean, look what's happening out there in cancel culture. I'm just talking about this and it's not really a big deal. But it is a big deal because it's not kingdom culture. It's not how Jesus wants us to behave. And let me say that, you know, as a challenge to us all is, you know, if you are participating in that behavior, you need to stop. It's not okay. God doesn't like it. It's not okay to do it. And beyond that, if we don't participate in it, we see our friends and our colleagues participate in that, we should be confronting them and challenging them and say, hey, guys, this is not okay. This is not what it means to be a believer and to follow the way of Jesus. It creeps in. So what are we going to choose? The way of Jesus or the way of the world? Romans 12 verse 2 says, don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way you think. So that's part number one. So I wanted to lay a foundation of the importance of culture and understanding culture and the impact it has in our lives. Now, I wanted to pivot to the title of the sermon called Jesus the Rabbi. Jesus had many names, and we've gone through the series. We talked about Jesus the Anointed One. We've talked about what I can remember just from 2 weeks ago, but, you know, prophet, priest, and king. I'm sorry, I can't remember all the rest. But we talked about Jesus and these different titles, and he's the Son of God. But he's also called Rabbi. And that is probably the term most used by people at that time when they addressed Jesus or they thought about Jesus. He was a rabbi. So it's kind of important for us to understand, what does this mean? When people call Jesus a rabbi, what is a rabbi? And not only what is a rabbi, but what is a rabbi in first century Jewish culture? So, I'm going to read a bit of an excerpt from a book by John Mark Comer called Practicing the Way, where it really talks about understanding what a rabbi is. So the title rabbi literally means master. Rabbis were the spiritual masters of Israel. Not only were they the expert teachers of the scriptures, they were also magnetic examples of life with God, those special few who shine with an inner luminescence. Every rabbi had his yoke, which is a Hebrew idiom for his set of teachings, his way of reading scripture, his take on how to thrive as a human being in God's world, how you too could taste a little of what they tasted. Just an aside, remember the scripture where Jesus says, "My yoke is easy"? That's what he's talking about. So the people of the day would understand that when they talked about my yoke, would be his, as a rabbi, his way of life, his teachings, how to thrive in this world. Rabbis came from a broad cross-section of society. They would have been farmers or blacksmiths or even carpenters. Most trained under another rabbi for many years. They began to teach and call their own disciples around the age of 30. But there's no formal certification like in our modern educational system. Authority worked differently. Your life and teaching were your credentials. Rabbis were mostly unpaid. Some worked their farms or ran a business for seasons of the year and then traveled in the off-season. They walked from town to town to teach in whatever synagogue would have them. They often spoke in parables and riddles. Normally, they traveled with a small band of disciples, teaching not in a classroom, but in the open air and along the road. Not from a textbook or curriculum, but from the Torah and the school of life. Over and over again, in the four Gospels, Jesus is addressed as rabbi. But he was no ordinary rabbi. Everywhere he went, the crowds were astonished and overwhelmed with wonder. Luke wrote, "All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips." Mark said, "The people were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as teachers of the law." They gave feedback like, "Where did this man get this wisdom?" And even no one spoke the way this man does. So a bit of context of a rabbi, a teacher in that day. Now, we often think of Jesus as Son of God, and he's holy, and he's kind, and he's generous, and he's loving. But how many times do we think, you know what, Jesus was really smart? Like, he was really intelligent. I mean, he's arguably the greatest teacher of all time when it comes to matters of human flourishing. Now think about it. The Christian religion is really following the life and the teachings of Jesus. I mean, how many Christians or people that say they are Christians that somehow acknowledge that Jesus as his life and his teachings are there in the world? I did a bit of research. There's something like 2.5 billion professed Christians in the world today. So that's today. Imagine for like the last 2,000 years, how many people have been impacted and have taken seriously the teachings of this man, Jesus. It's hard to get numbers, but there was one number that said like something like 13.5 billion people in the last 2,000 years. I mean, name another teacher that has that kind of influence on people. And then our own personal experience. I mean, 2,000 years later, we commit ourselves to this man, Jesus. We take his teachings seriously, and our lives are changed. I can personally testify that my life has changed over the last 20 years of following Jesus. And it's not just because I'm doing stuff. It's because I'm following this great man, this great teacher who I respect. The thing is, how can you follow someone you don't trust and respect? Well, that's a bit of a problem in the Christian church today, is that people would rather follow some celebrity or some politician or some pastor gone rogue that's maybe charismatic and put those people ahead and what they say and what they do and what they teach ahead of the teachings of Jesus. And it's like there are certain like key themes today in our modern world, and it's like, well, let's not worry about what Jesus said about it. What Jesus said, maybe it doesn't really apply anymore. That's the greatest teacher that ever lived. Now let's listen to whoever is kind of speaking today and kind of aligns with the modern culture that we are in. So that's the first kind of key is, do we really believe and see Jesus as this incredible teacher with great wisdom, great insight, who we should follow and trust and respect? Because he calls us to follow him, but like, what are we following? We're following this great man. Okay, he's not only a rabbi, he's also the Son of God, but he is also an incredible teacher. And we should trust him and respect him and follow him. Now let's talk about following, because that's what we are called to do. So a rabbi had disciples, and the disciples were his followers. And we are called to be disciples of Jesus, right? So that hasn't changed. I mean, if it's not like in those days, disciples, and today, we are not. We are still called to be disciples, and Jesus told his disciples to go out and make disciples of the nation. So this is a continuous thing. We are meant to be his disciples. So discipleship, or another word that John Mark Comer likes to use, he calls it apprenticeship, was the pinnacle of the first century Jewish educational system. So much like a PhD or a graduate program is in our system today. So to understand discipleship, maybe good to look again at the culture and the context of the time to see what that educational system was like, to give us a better idea of what it means to be discipleship or to be a disciple in those days. So from what I've been able to gather is Jewish children started school around 5 years old at the local, and I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, so Bet Sefer, which is the house of the book. That's not very French, eh? It didn't sound like Jewish. Anyway, the house of the book, which was the equivalent of elementary school. Normally the Bet Sefer was built onto the side of the synagogue and run by a full-time scribe or teacher. The curriculum was the Torah, which is the first few books of the Bible. And in an oral culture, by the age 12 or 13, most kids would have the entire Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy memorized. I can't hardly memorize anything, so that's pretty impressive. At that point, the vast majority of students went home. They would apprentice in the family business or help run the farm. But the best and the brightest would go on to a second level of education called Bet Midrash, the house of learning, where they would continue their studies. By the age of 17, they would have memorized, what do you think? The entire Old Testament. I mean, memorized the entire Old Testament. I mean, it's ridiculous. These kids were bright. Now, at this point, the overwhelming majority were done, and they were basically told to go make babies, pray that your children became rabbis, and ply your trade. But the best of the best of the best would apply to apprentice under a rabbi. Now, this was like really hard to get into. Apprenticeship programs were extremely exclusive. You had to find a rabbi whose yoke, so teachings, lifestyle you were drawn to, and then beg to join his band of students. The rabbi would grill you. How well do you know the Torah? What is your take on the Nephilim in Genesis? Do you side with Hillel or Shammai on Deuteronomy 24? Tell me, how often do you pray? And if you thought you had the smarts and the work ethic to one day become a rabbi yourself, you would say something like, okay, come, follow me. Or another way to translate that is, come, apprentice under me. Now let's say you are one of the lucky few who became an apprentice to a rabbi. From that day on, your world, your entire life, was organized around three driving goals. So these were the three driving goals. If this works, there we go. So number one, first was to be with your rabbi. So this wasn't like an education system that we have today. I'm going to do my MBA and I commit so many hours per week and in classes from, 9 to 12. This was your entire life. You left everything. You put everything behind. Your work, your career, the whole lot, your family, and you devoted your life 24/7 to being with your rabbi. Ate with him, traveled with him, ministered with him, sat under his teaching, 24/7. The idea was that you were so close to your rabbi. In fact, there was this blessing, I believe, that would be prayed over disciples who were going to now go under a rabbi, and that the blessing would go something like, may you be so close to your, I'm paraphrasing, sorry, that may you be so close to your rabbi that the dust of his feet would basically like cover you. So this is the idea that you'd be walking so close and that the dust that came off his feet would basically be all over your body. That's how close you would be to him. So it was a 24/7 devotion to your rabbi. So that was the first driving goal. And then the whole point of that, the whole kind of soul and heart of this was to become like your rabbi. So spending so much time with your rabbi, you would ultimately become like him. You would try and, remember Paul says, imitate me as I imitate Christ? Like imitation. So, you know, you'd see how your rabbi speaks and what he says and what their teachings, even sometimes some of their mannerisms you might pick up. The goal was to become like your rabbi because you trusted this rabbi. You believed in this rabbi. You trust in his teaching, in his way of life. You saw the thriving that there was in his life and say, I want that. I want to be like this rabbi. And then the third was then the ultimate goal was to do as your rabbi did. After spending time with your rabbi, if you had got to the point where you had kind of graduated and if the rabbi had decided that, yes, you are now at that place, he would say something like, go and make other disciples. Go find your other disciples and teach them in this way. That's what it meant to be a disciple. So that Jesus model of that day, it hasn't changed today. Nowhere in the Bible do you read, okay, that was only good for then, but it's not good for now. The challenge is that when, as Christians and as the church, over time, as we think about discipleship and being a disciple, that's not what we think about often. Sometimes we're thinking more about things like mentorship. I mean, mentorship is not discipleship. We think about maybe, you know, Jesus as our life coach. A life coach is a big thing. No, that's not what discipleship is. It's about this complete and devotion to Jesus as our teacher. The Jesus model, which is be with Jesus, become like him, and do as he did. Sounds simple, right? Not complicated. The way of Jesus overall is not a complicated model. All he's saying is, come and follow me. Now, the following is a challenge. Like we've said, you know, there are the culture of our day, the things that influence us, the world that we live in, that is continuously trying to take us away from following Jesus like that. Now, is it any, I mean, if you think about it, is it surprising that we find some of these things so difficult to do? Because reality is we live in a world where it's, you know, there is an enemy that is trying to distract us from becoming more like Jesus. Why does it sometimes become so difficult to spend time with him and to read the word and meditate and do all those things that help us to become like him? So it means that we have to be intentional about this. This doesn't just happen automatically. We have to be intentional, put in the effort to become more like Jesus, to spend time with him, to spend time with our rabbi. Jesus says, if any of you wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way, take up your cross daily, and follow him. The Christian life and the call of Jesus isn't opposed to effort. Grace isn't opposed to effort, it's just opposed to earning. You cannot earn your salvation. But that doesn't mean there's no effort in trying to become more like him. And that effort means laying down things of this world and taking up that cross and following Jesus every day. This is a lifelong journey of apprenticeship, every facet of our lives, 24/7. Time went quick. Felt like quick for me anyway. I just want to call up the worship team, if you don't mind. So to end off, I've got kind of two questions to take away. And the first question is, do you see Jesus as your rabbi? Have you got that revelation, this great teacher that we should trust and follow and respect what he has to say? And I say that because as we go into the next series of Preparing the Way and we go through the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is going to say some stuff that is really going to rattle some people. It is pretty intense. and it's direct, and it's totally countercultural. And at that point, we have a decision. Are we going to trust him and follow him and believe in him and actually put those things into practice, that it's more than just head knowledge, that we're building on the foundation that is there, as Matt said this morning? Or are we going to ignore it and just carry on? So is Jesus your rabbi? And do you place your trust on matters of life somewhere else or in him? And the second one is, as a disciple, are you and I prepared to go on a lifelong journey of apprenticeship? Because it is a call to come and follow. And it is a choice for you to follow. You don't have to. You always have a choice. But the question is, do we believe in Jesus? Do you understand who Jesus is enough to put those things aside and follow him? And let me just say that this message is so much for me. I get frustrated with myself. I don't know if you do. Not myself. Well, I have multiple personalities. I get frustrated with myself for, like, so often where I choose a different path than, like, following Jesus, where I get distracted by things instead of devoting everything 24/7. So I'm on this journey, and I want to encourage everybody to go on this journey with me. And some of you are probably way further ahead than me. Some of you might be starting it or behind. Some of you might be in it and you've fallen off the path. I just want to say that Jesus says in the book of John, you should have read it at some point, he says that whoever comes to me, I will never ever cast away. So no matter where you are in this journey, maybe some of you feel, well, you know, I'm too far gone. I've too gone off the path. I cannot get back. No, you can. You can come back onto that journey of following Jesus. He is waiting and ready. So my encouragement this morning to all of us is to surrender our lives to Jesus fully, 24/7. To not be swayed and distracted by other distractions in this world, other people's philosophies and so-called wisdom. Sure, they help, but it's not in place of Jesus.